The 60s, the Culture War, the End of Christendom. The 10th talk in a series on Christianity in America was presented by Tim McIntosh on May 29, 2013, at an evening class of McKinsey Study Center, an institute of Gutenberg College. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2013. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
How's it going? All right, I'm going to do my little tag at the beginning. This is Gutenberg College, May 29, 2013. My name is Tim McIntosh, and this is the last in a 10-week series about Christianity in the United States. This week is called The Hippies, The Culture War, and The End of Christendom. How's that? Wow. I mean, if you're not interested, you don't have a pulse. Let me real quickly cover what we talked about last week. Last week was three reforming trends in the church. The first was reforming Catholicism. The second was reforming theological modernism. The third was reforming fundamentalism. I'm just going to give a real quick overview of those three. So, reforming Catholicism, we talked about Vatican II, which happened in the middle of the 1960s. Previous to Vatican II, the Catholic Church had adopted kind of a militaristic anti-modernization stance. And I don't mean modernization meaning computers and railroad tracks. I mean much more broadly than that. The Catholic Church, since the Reformation, had largely had sensed itself maybe losing power, losing cultural control, and they held two big councils. The first council happened right in the middle of the Reformation, and they basically said, we are against the Reformation in this way, in this way, in this way, in this way. Then, in the mid-1800s, Vatican I basically was a refutation of all of the errors of kind of modern trends in the world. But in the mid-60s, a little placeholder pope, everyone thought he was going to be a placeholder pope, named John the 23rd, becomes pope. He's 70 years old. He's 77 years old. Everyone expects that he's going to be around for a couple of years, and then he's going to pass on. But he decides, oh, no. He is going to turn the church upside down. So in 1963, he calls for another churchwide council, Vatican II, and his goal, expressly stated, is to just be a good shepherd to the Catholic Church. That's all he's ever really wanted to be, is just a good shepherd. And Vatican II is a reforming council toward that end. So the Catholic Church, previous to 1963, the Mass was said in what language? Latin. Not in your language, in Latin. After Vatican II, the Mass was spoken in your language, the language of your country. Moreover, the altar was moved forward, closer to the congregation. The priest did not perform the service with his back turned to the congregation, but now, after Vatican II, turned toward the congregation. So there are all these changes in the liturgy that John the 23rd wanted to bring about, because he just wanted to be a good pastor, and he felt like the church had become extremely, or had just remained very hierarchical. The world had changed drastically, so he wanted to, what was the Italian word? Aggiornamento, I think, to bringing up to date. Second movement was reforming theological modernism. So in the 20s and 30s, there are a lot of young European seminary students, and they have been raised in theological modernism. Theological modernism gets its real beginning with a theologian named Friedrich Schleiermacher. Schleiermacher says, he's a German, and he says, what do we mean when we say religion? What we really mean is we just mean that kind of internal impulse toward the divine. That's what we mean. That's the beginning of religion. And a person who calls himself Christian is a person, when he has that inborn experience of the divine, associates that with Christ. That's what the Christian religion is. Maybe someone else might associate it with Allah or with his prophet Muhammad. They would be a Muslim. But that same impulse drives both of them, drives both the Christian and the Muslim and the Hindu. It manifests itself in different ways. But Schleiermacher is just trying to give an account of religion. And it ends up kind of spawning a new movement that I called modernism. In the 20th century, it was more frequently called liberalism. After Schleiermacher, there comes to be a real suspicion of all things supernatural in theology. So the resurrection of Christ, the miracles of Christ, the virgin birth, all these things were viewed with real skepticism. Coming out of that, there's a fundamentalist reaction to that. I'll talk about the fundamentalists in 1 second. But the modernists, a lot of the young seminarians in the early part of the 20th century are raised in theological modernism, and they're about to go into churches, and they're kind of thinking, well, what are we going to preach? We don't really have anything to preach. Let's see if I can remember the famous quote by Richard Niebuhr. In theological modernism, a Christ without a cross was raised in a world without sin and ushered in a kingdom of God, you know, basically that had no meaning to it. And so these young seminarians are like, what in the world? Why are we doing this? So there's a counter movement, neo-orthodoxy. The vanguard of neo-orthodoxy, Jack mentioned him last hour, is a man named Karl Barth. Karl Barth wrote a huge systematic theology called The Church Dogmatics. And a journalist one time asked him, can you summarize the 8-volume Church Dogmatics for us? And he said, sure, Jesus loves me, this I know, for the Bible tells me so. And he's kind of saying it tongue-in-cheek, but he's also serious. That's kind of what neo-orthodoxy is all about. It's a back-to-the-Bible movement with a slight variation on the approach to the scriptures from the fundamentalists. I won't go into that right now. We can talk about it after class if you'd like to. The fundamentalists, meanwhile, after the Scopes trial of the 1920s, the fundamentalists are a majority within churches, but feel themselves sort of as if they were an oppressed minority, because more and more churchmen in the United States had come back from European seminaries kind of trained in theological modernism. So the fundamentalists are the pew sitters for the most part, and they're hearing the modernists preach, and they think, this is not what I signed up for. This is not the Bible that I read. So there's a counter movement, fundamentalism. Fundamentalism, though, in the 20s and 30s becomes a very hostile movement. Narrow ties, narrower theological beliefs. And in the 40s, some fundamentalists start kind of waking up to this, and they push back and they say, come on, we like to celebrate that modernism is kind of dying now, but we've got our own problems. So out of that move, out of the fundamentalist movement, are born the evangelicals. The three most prominent evangelicals are Carl F. H. Henry, Billy Graham, and Francis Schaeffer. Because you're associated with Gutenberg and Reformation Fellowship, you probably know Francis Schaeffer the most, because he's been so influential on Gutenberg. So those are the three reforming movements we talked about last week. This week, as I promised, the 1960s, the ensuing culture war, and the end of Christendom. When I have whenever I have tried to understand the 1960s, I have had these long conversations with my mom and dad, because my mom and dad were right smack in the middle of it. And I love hearing the stories that they tell. Mom was raised in Southern California. Dad was raised in Kentucky. They're still married, by the way. They met on the campus of UCLA, where my dad was a basketball player. My dad said, and I believe he was really earnest when he said this, that he took a summer break. He would work off campus when he was going to UCLA. He goes to work off campus. He doesn't set foot on UCLA's campus during the summer of 1965. He drives back on campus, and he's driving kind of down the side roads on campus, and he's looking at the way that people are dressed, and he thinks, I've taken a wrong turn. I'm on the wrong campus, because nobody looks the way that they looked before I left. Meaning, all of his guys were wearing Bermuda shorts and kind of button-down shirts, and they had collars, and the girls, my mom told me about this, the girls were wearing dye-to-match outfits. I don't know what that is. And rollered hair. And dad comes back and he looks around and he sees the long hair and the bell-bottom jeans and the flower shirts. And he thinks, what in the world happened? And he said at UCLA, it happened that fast. It happened literally, he said, during the course of a summer. I read a book called The Dust of Death by Oz Guinness. And I remember reading it and thinking, oh, I finally understood the 1960s. And I went to my mom and dad and I said, the 1960s was terrifying. When you look back, it's always remembered as kind of, Kent State was a little bit of a blip. And the Vietnam War was really awful. And yeah, the nuclear arms race was really scary. But it was the Beatles, and it was joints, and it was, there were great things about it. But I get the impression from The Dust of Death, this book by Oz Guinness, that there was a lot of terror. And my mom said, Tim, we were afraid to open up the newspaper because it was so scary. So Cold War tensions, bomb shelters on campus, constant threat of nuclear war, Nikita Khrushchev, the Russian... not prime minister, what is the name of the Russian head? Premier. Banging on the lectern at the United Nations saying, we will bury you with a shoe. The standoff of the Cuban Missile Crisis, the Bay of Pigs, the assassination of John F. Kennedy, the rising death toll of Vietnam War, the assassination of Martin Luther King Jr. My parents were right in the middle of the Watts riots in L.A., the assassination of Robert Kennedy, Kent State students being shot and killed. And great and great inflation. 1966. Okay, I'm going to ask you about that. I wonder what happened to we'll talk about that. I'm curious. My mom recently visited me here in Eugene, and I live just around the corner from Gutenberg, and just down the street from me is a John Henry Newman Center. My mom and I were taking a walk, and my mom said, oh, a Newman Center. When President Kennedy was shot, I went to a Newman Center because it just seemed like a kind of a religious place to go. I had been raised in a church, but it didn't mean really anything to me. We went every Sunday, but I didn't think I'm going to stop and pray. But I went to the Newman Center and I prayed and other people were there and we were all really scared. And so the kind of culmination of all these scary events for my mom and dad was we need to figure out what we're about. Because we may not be here tomorrow. I have not lived through anything like that. 9/11 was scary for about 2 weeks, but then it was over. When I was in grade school, we still had kind of nuclear bomb preparatory drills in which we would get under our desk. And I remember being a little bit afraid, maybe the Russians are going to bomb us, something like that. But it wasn't like this looming sense of terror. I get the impression from my mom, dad, their friends, there is this kind of looming sense of terror on the horizon. And there's this strong push to figure out what you believed. Culturally, as best I can understand it, three different options opened up for my parents on UCLA's campus. First was you could be a critic. So you could look back at America's cultural history. And you could see that, man, it came with a lot of baggage. It's not just the Vietnam War was sketchy, but mass racism. My dad's roommate in college was Kenny Washington, a black man. This was 1963. They were the first black and white roommates to play Division I basketball in American history. I was like, Dad, that was 1963. That wasn't that long ago. He's like, yeah, I know. I mean, racism was like really, really powerful and real. That story just stunned me that there was no Division I basketball players, black and white, up until that time. So the critics could look back at American history and see that America had lots and lots of baggage, and they made a critical turn. So most prominently, those critics who wanted to do something about it pointed to racism and got involved in the civil rights movement. I'm going to pause and talk about the civil rights movement, then I'm going to come back to the critical strain, and then we'll continue our story. So, civil rights movement. Between Reconstruction, after the Civil War in the 1950s, it was black ministers and black churches who often played the role of community leaders. They were typically the best educated, and they were not dependent on whites' goodwill for their salary. So it's not any coincidence that black ministers like Martin Luther King Jr., Ralph Abernathy, Jesse Jackson, Andrew Young, etc., led the civil rights movement. In the mid-20th century, there will be a handful of black organizations that develop that are not linked to churches, like the NAACP and the Urban League. But at the beginning of the civil rights movement, it is largely driven through black pastors in black churches. Martin Luther King Jr. is the son of a pastor who had a prosperous congregation in Atlanta. His father was politically connected, and he led rent strikes in Atlanta. Martin Luther King Jr., as a boy in 1939, sang with his church choir at the Atlanta premiere of the movie Gone with the Wind at the Fox Theater. I've been there many, many times. He was educated in Northern School, and he studied for his doctorate at Boston University. Did you know that? When Rosa Parks was arrested for riding on the front of the bus in Montgomery in 1955, an organization was formed to protest her arrest in the Montgomery bus system. Martin Luther King Jr. was elected head of the organization. He was a young man. I think he was 25 or 26. He leaned heavily on churches, which was the one black organization that could organize and motivate African Americans to stay off buses. Mass meetings were held at King's Church and other churches. Martin Luther King said that when he would preach, and before he started preaching, television cameras would be set up all over the place. Television cameras wouldn't turn on until about 5 minutes left in the sermon, because that's when he would start talking about, all right, here's how we're going to organize, and this is what we're going to do this week. So the TV cameras weren't really interested in the sermons, only interested in how they were going to protest the Montgomery bus system. King trained men and women to participate in the sit-ins without retaliating. This way the movement could retain higher moral ground. The culmination of the civil rights movement was the March on Washington for Jobs and Freedom in 1963, culminating with Martin Luther King Jr.'s I Have a Dream speech, which is surely, it's up there with Lincoln's Gettysburg Address, second inaugural address, is like just the best American rhetoric. Begins with the words 50 years ago, which is an allusion to the Gettysburg Address. It culminates with, I have a dream that every valley shall be exalted, citing Isaiah 44. We are not satisfied and we will not be satisfied until justice rolls down like waters and righteousness like a mighty stream, quoting Amos 5:24. What's interesting about the civil rights movement is that the critics of the 60s, the kind of critics branch, align themselves with the civil rights movement. And the civil rights movement, as led by black pastors, is overtly Christian in its imagery and in its language. But the critics are going to divorce themselves after that from the kind of like Christian heritage of the United States. So this is a strange kind of time in the 1960s that the critics endorse what Martin Luther King Jr. is saying, even though it's surrounded with biblical imagery, but they will then divorce themselves and separate themselves from kind of like the Christian history of the United States. I think the best way to think about the critical wing of the 1960s, and when I say the critical wing, I'm thinking, yes, the hippies, but not everybody that was a hippie was critical of the United States and critical of kind of like the inherited values given to them of the 1960s. I think the best way to think about what was happening with the hippies in the 1960s is that it was the last of the great American revival movements, but it now gets stripped of all things Christianity. So if you've been sitting in on this class, we've talked about there have been major revival movements beginning with just before the American Revolution, the First Great Awakening, mid-1800s, Second Great Awakening, and there have been other awakenings since then, perhaps not as large as the First and Second Great Awakening. But what happens is there'll be an upswell of interest in Christianity coupled with very charismatic preachers like Jonathan Edwards, like John Wesley. But throughout American history, the kind of those awakenings become, to my way of thinking, kind of less based in the Bible, more motivated in kind of personal spiritual actualization or something like that. And I think sort of the last great revival movement is the hippie movement of the 1960s, but it's just divorced of all things Christianity now. I think that's the easiest way to think about it. There's a liberal theologian named Harvey Cox. He wrote a book called The Secular City. Here's his quote. Quote, "Hippiness represents a historical American quest for a faith that warms the heart. In religion, a person can experience deeply and feel intensely. The Love Inns are the 20th century equivalent of the 19th century Methodist camp meeting, with the same kind of fervor and the same thirst for a God who speaks through emotion and not through anagrams of doctrine. Of course, the gospel that is preached differs somewhat in content, but then content was never important for the revivalists. It was the spirit that counted." Cox is not exactly right if he groups the First Great Awakening in with that statement, that the content was never important for the revivalists. The content was very important for Jonathan Edwards, very important for George Whitefield. It does change after that. It becomes less important with the Second Great Awakening. I think it becomes less important during the great Pentecostalist movement that begins in the early part of the 20th century. In the critical movement, two trends converge. First is the neglect or open rejection of Christian influence upon American culture. The second is the rejection of an optimistic humanism that had kind of been lingering in American culture. So, Thomas Jefferson and others believed that humanism, or the reason of the Enlightenment, could arbitrate between complete competing religious claims and could step in when Christianity finally lost its grip on American culture. It's an optimistic movement. Things are going to get better. And it seems like maybe, I think perhaps the high point of this movement is maybe when we put a man on the moon. I remember Walter Cronkite, I was not alive, but I've seen the reruns of Walter Cronkite making the broadcast about Americans landing on the moon and becoming emotional, taking his glasses off and becoming emotional, because this is the culmination of a sense that we can solve our problems through technology, science, and rationality. And I think he may have been the last, that was maybe the dying embers of that optimistic humanism. Because when the 60s hit, there's already been in Europe and creeping in the United States a sense that we have lost our way. We talked a couple weeks ago about the literature of the early 20th century, F. Scott Fitzgerald, Ernest Hemingway, Franz Kafka. There's this deep sense that we have become spiritually lost, alienated. We don't know who we are anymore. The modern world is terrifying. The modern world is bureaucratic. The modern world is anti-spiritual in some way. So I think that pessimism gets kind of linked in to the critical wing of the 1960s students. Then there were the traditionalists, and my parents belong in this. For my parents, they looked back on their history, and they didn't think, we need new values. They thought, well, we've never really embraced these values. We don't really read the Bible anymore, even though everybody goes to church. So there was a sense from my parents that they were raised in a culture that kind of gave lip service to the Bible, but nobody really knew the Bible. And so for my mom and dad, they met and then they started attending Campus Crusade for Christ. And it was all about trying to learn and understand what the Bible was about. My goodness, this book that everyone talked about, but no one ever read. That's what it was about for my parents. There was a third option. I'm going to skip the third. Now let's talk about the third option. It's just such a small movement. I would call these the radical traditionalists. Are you guys familiar with Jesus People USA, JAPUSA? So the Jesus People used to hang out in Haight-Ashbury in San Francisco, and they would witness to disillusioned hippies. The play and the movie Jesus Christ Superstar, maybe that's kind of indicative of Jesus People USA. Like so many movements of earlier time, claimed that Jesus was much like them, long-haired, bearded. He turned his face to the material world and wandered around uttering profound thoughts. And of course, part of that is true. I just don't know that Jesus was a hippie. But I'm going to admit this. When I pictured Jesus, I still picture him as a hippie. What's wrong with me? I know he wasn't wearing a three-piece suit, but I know that he wasn't a hippie either. What's that?
He at least had dreads.
Yeah, he probably had dreads. After the cultural atomic bomb blew up in the 1960s, the critics and traditionalists got jobs, had families, graduate degrees, and the battle that was waged on campus drifted into American culture at large. Jimmy Carter ran for office as a Democrat in 1976 and described himself as an evangelical, born-again Christian. But his presidency displeased a grassroots political movement that had grown out of fundamentalism and evangelicalism called the religious right. Jerry Falwell was a pastor of the Thomas Road Baptist Church in Lynchburg, Virginia, and he created a political action committee, a PAC, called the Moral Majority in 1979. And he is the first prominent spokesperson to use the phrase religious right. The religious right was a loose conglomeration of fundamentalists, Pentecostals, evangelicals, and Catholics who, all seeing signs of decline in American morality, became extremely active in the political arena and the social sphere. The religious right was doing battle, and their opponents were what Peter Berger, who's a sociologist that I'll talk about a little bit at the end of class, their opponents were the new class, sometimes called secular humanists, sometimes called liberals. The new class were religious crusaders of a different sort. They typically were involved in the higher echelons of American society, government, schools, television programming, etc., and there developed an antagonism that Peter Berger describes in the most helpful way I have ever heard. Peter Berger says, the least religious nation on the planet is Sweden. The most religious country in the world is India. The United States is India, ruled by Swedes. That makes a lot of sense to me. To counter the agenda of the new class, the religious right preached, marched, and demonstrated. The roots of the religious right lay in the 1970s, namely with the Roe versus Wade decision of 1973, which prohibited laws against abortion, a ballot proposal in 1978, which tried to expand the legal protection of homosexuals, and a battle over the Equal Rights Amendment, a movement which would have granted women legal protection as an amendment to the Constitution. Jerry Falwell was opposed to the wording of the amendment as adopted by Congress, felt that it would open the door to homosexual marriages and adoptions, and it would allow women to be drafted into the armed services. So powerful was the religious right in 1984 that Democratic candidate for the president, Walter Mondale, mentioned Jerry Falwell no less than three times in his debate with the Republican candidate Ronald Reagan. We are now caught up with church history. I'm only going to 1984. It is a good year. I am going to talk a little bit about what I think is like the biggest change that is kind of coming, that it, that is now and that is kind of coming down the pipe. As I said, the class is three parts: the 1960s, the culture war, and the end of Christendom. So, when I think about my relationship to my parents, I feel like maybe what a second or third generation Puritan maybe would have felt like with regards to his parents, okay? The Puritans were fighting the British, excuse me, were fighting the Catholics over in England. They were losing, members of the Puritans were losing their head. Violent, awful. The Puritans come to the United States out of that chaos, out of that war. And they want to start a Christian civilization. They want to start a Christian civilization. They want to do it differently than the Puritans that remained in England. And what they wanted is they wanted England to look at them in the New World and say, they're doing it right. Let's do that same thing over here. And the Puritans hoped that they would be called back to England. The trouble was, after two or three generations passed, that project had largely failed. When I used to study the second and third generation Puritans, I used to think, man, the Puritans, they had all the moral fervor, their kids chickened out. I'm a little bit more forgiving now because, like I said, I identify with second and third generation Puritans, and I'm like, I don't think it's necessarily that our, that moral passion has failed, but the world around them has changed so drastically. That's what I think has happened. So, for the second and third generation Puritans, they were probably looking at their neighbors and saying, boy, our parents won't let John, my neighbor, own property or vote or run for political office if he's not part of the church. And become part of the church, he has to do some pretty severe things. It seems fair to me that John should be able to own property even if he's not part of the church. So in two or three generations, the Puritans back off their initial ideals that you had to be not just a church-going member, but a devout church-going member to basically participate in any sort of social life. So, like I said, I kind of feel like a second or third generation Puritan. I have talked so much with my mom and dad about what happened in the 60s. I feel like I have a better sense of what went on, and I also feel like the world has changed very dramatically since then. I feel like I can understand the culture war, but I feel like my students and a lot of my peers don't, they just don't buy into the culture war anymore. The time has kind of passed for the culture war. I think that what has changed is that Christendom ended. And I'm going to kind of try to, explain what I mean by that. There's a theologian named Stanley Hauerwas. He's still alive. And he wrote a book called Resident Aliens, and the opening two or three pages is worth buying the whole book. I'm going to give a synopsis of what he said. Christendom ended, says Stanley Hauerwas, on a Sunday evening in 1963 in Greenville, South Carolina. That Sunday evening in Greenville, South Carolina, the Fox Theater opened its doors in defiance of the state-honored blue laws. So, previous to that time, movies aren't shown on Sundays, but on that Sunday afternoon in 1963, the theater decided, you know what? Who cares about the blue laws? We're going to open our doors. That night, Hauerwas and six of his friends from the Methodist Youth Fellowship snuck out the back door of the church and joined John Wayne at the Fox Theater. That evening, says Hauerwas, represented a watershed in the history of Christendom because that night, South Carolina, the last pocket of resistance to secularity in the Western world, announced it would no longer be a prop for the church. No more free passes for the church, no more free rides. Hauerwas's parents never worried about whether he and his friends would grow up Christian because the church was the only show in town. There was a traffic jam on Sunday mornings when everybody in Greenville went to Sunday school. And by overlooking much of what was wrong, i.e. a racially segregated world, people saw a world that looked good and right. Parents affirmed that world by taking their children to church. Quote, church, home, and state, writes Hauerwas, formed a national consortium that worked to instill Christian values. The trouble is, says Hauerwas, nobody believes this today. Some might still believe that by electing a few Christian senators or by balancing the budget, we can revive Christian culture. But ask any young mother, car mechanic, or I have in here Gutenberg student. That's not what Harold Ross wrote. If one becomes a Christian by being born here or breathing American air, and the gentle answer would be no. Christianity is no longer the canopy of meaning under which we live and move and breathe. So think back to Alexis de Tocqueville. Alexis de Tocqueville, writing in the mid-1800s, says that Christianity in the United States rules by common assent. It rules by common assent. The moral world is fixed. Parents, neighbors, schools were committed to the same project of raising kids who believed in hard work, diligence, honesty. And while there may have been dissenters from the project, that dissent was probably more private than public. I'm not claiming that everybody is Christian. Don't hear that. I'm just claiming, like, as a cultural, the cultural furniture was in place, and that cultural furniture was quasi-Christian. There may have been objectors like H.L. Mencken in the 1920s. He may have professed agnosticism, but he was a rare bird. But by 1963, says Harawas, quote, South Carolina, the last pocket of resistance to secularity in the Western world, announced it would no longer be a prop for the church. Now, I'm going to quibble a little bit with Harawas for a second here over one word. South Carolina, I just sounded like I was from South Carolina. South Carolina, the last pocket of resistance to secularity in the Western world, announced it would no longer be a prop for the church. It was widely expected for a long time that with Christianity kind of losing its place, that what was going to take its place was something like a secular rationalism. That has not happened. There is a sociologist that Nigel and I, like I mentioned earlier, his name's Peter Burger. Nigel's going to do his senior thesis using Peter Burger. That's still the case. Peter Berger says that he entered sociology, and he says everybody when he enters sociology, he's got his PhD, widely acclaimed kind of public academic, everybody believed the secularization thesis. What is the secularization thesis? The notion that as the world becomes more modern, it becomes more secular and less religious. But Berger and his friends stopped and they looked around and they said, is that really the case? And so they do all sorts of like research, questionnaires, you know, in-depth interviews, and it's not the case. What's happening is that the United States is actually growing more pluralistic, much more pluralistic, radically pluralistic. So here's Berger. Ever since the Enlightenment, intellectuals of every stripe have believed that the inevitable consequence of modernity is the decline of religion. The reason was supposed to be the progress of science and its concomitant rationality, replacing the irrationality and superstition of religion. Not to put too fine a point on it, but they were mistaken. Modernity is not intrinsically secularizing, though it has been so in particular cases like Western Europe. Modernity is not necessarily secularizing, it is necessarily pluralizing. Modernity is characterized by an increasing plurality within the same society of different beliefs, values, and worldviews. Simply put, modernity is not characterized by the absence of gods, by the absence of God, but by the presence of many gods. So, this should sound familiar to Christians, because it sounds to me like we are going back to the place where the gospel found us. Think the Roman Empire. A strong, powerful government, a strong military, full of different gods. Full of different gods. Okay? So I kind of think that's the direction we're going back to, and I'm going to stop there. I had written out like all sorts of trends to go over, like remember the revivalist movement in the United States, how interesting that was. But I just thought it'd be interesting to stop and kind of have questions about my claim. And I'm pretty convinced of it, that Christendom has ended. Let me state it a little bit more abruptly. I think that because Christendom has ended largely without fanfare, people don't realize just how significant it was. I was at a restaurant the other day. There's a woman my age who's talking to her two friends. You've all had experiences like this. And she said, she was reading a book, and she looks at me and she says, "What was the Reformation?" Please tell me she's not talking about the Protestant Reformation. And her friends say, "What?" And she's like, "This guy, Martin Luther and the Reformation." And I was going, "Oh my goodness, I can't believe this. And it's exactly, she didn't know what the Reformation was. And so her friends, thankfully, did, and her friends kind of explained it to her. And I just thought to myself, if you are a historical self, which all of us are, we are historical selves, not only, but we are historical selves. How can you understand who you are without understanding what the Reformation is? But culturally, that's kind of where we are. We're at this place where we kind of don't know who we are. It's a very strange thing. And I think there's no going back to where we came from. I think there's kind of only going back to this place that started 1700 years, that ended 1700 years ago. Namely, Christianity was born into a pagan, very pluralistic, full of God society. That's kind of where the gospel was first hatched, and I think that's where we're headed. Okay, end of me talking. Questions, comments? Well, can I name some of those gods that we were talking about? Allah is one. Shiva is another. I think something like the thing that I see in Eugene more than anything else is kind of a democratic universalism, which is kind of associated with yoga practices and this sense that there's a spirit in all of us, and if we cleanse our minds, we can see the real truth. I'm not just talking Peter Berger's thesis applies to the United States, but it applies broadly to all industrialized countries. So we might not see a big boom in Islam in the United States right now, but I think it's coming fairly soon.
Okay, as I don't know that I'm disagreeing with you, but it just seems to me that if you took a survey or something, most people would say they believe in God, and their ideas would differ on around the edges, but it seems we're not that pluralistic in that most people just kind of believe in God, but it has no real impact on their life. So we are kind of secular. We just believe in God. So I don't know if that's compared to the Roman Empire. The groups you're talking about are still pretty minor groups in the United States.
I think that's true. And I think maybe one of the ways in which we'd be different from the Roman world is that our gods are more DIY gods, meaning I don't expect that a temple to Shiva is going to sprout up on the corner in Eugene, Oregon. But I do think some sort of kind of like make it yourself religion is kind of the way that it's happening now. Although, let me back up and say, Eugene is a pretty ethnically, it's not terribly ethnically diverse. Despite shouts to the contrary, it's not very ethnically diverse. Just to compare my experience with you in Eugene to my experience in Atlanta, two blocks from my parents' house, the house that I grew up in, is the nation's second largest Hindu temple. I mean, it is huge and it's beautiful. It's gorgeous. So I think part of the pluralization, it's not just that white post-Protestant Christians are choosing a bunch of different gods, but demographically we've gotten so pluralistic. And with that pluralism, with people moving in from different parts all over the world, there are different gods that are kind of coming into the United States in that way. So it's not just white Protestants saying, "I'm going to choose to worship Shiva," but it's demographically, ethnically, the United States is changing pretty dramatically.
That's true, but the white Protestants, I think, fall into two groups, pretty much secular and Christian for the most part. And then we do have groups moving in, but It's not as if the end of Christendom meant the white Protestants went out and found different religions. They just became secular people that believe in God. He just doesn't bother them at all with any kind of ethical issues. So
maybe to help explain, I'm thinking when Tim said, like, Christendom has ended, I remembered my husband, who was a grad student at Boston University, coming home and telling me that he was talking with another grad student who grew up in Georgia. She's teaching a writing class, and she wanted to teach a writing class something, I can't remember what it was, but something to do with something in the Bible. And so she asked at this college that's private, fairly diverse, but quite expensive. So you have, to some extent, you have just a kind of a narrow sliver of Americans. She asked the class, how many of you know who Judas was? And I can't remember. It was something crazy, like a third of the students knew generally that this was someone who betrayed someone, you know, like as a kind of as a type.
Yeah.
And like she was a little stunned.
Yeah.
So, I mean, just hearing you say that makes me remember him saying that and kind of thinking, like, I mean, as a culture, we really don't know Christianity anymore.
Yeah.
So I know everybody wants to talk about the end of Christian American culture as we see it, but I'm actually interested in a, kind of a side thing. Clearly, Dr. King's speech is like everybody. It doesn't matter what your particular views are on something. Everybody recognizes that that speech is like the cream of American rhetoric, like you said. But the cameras didn't turn on till after his sermon was finished. Do we know if his sermons are preserved in any capacity? And are they, I mean, because we have sermons from like Jonathan Edwards and these other revivalists, and you're sort of saying these are connected kinds of events. And have you read any of the?
Yeah.
Do you know? Are they is he as good an orator in his?
Oh, he's yeah. Great. When you read them, though, so I'm an evangelical, and coming from my evangelical background, there's something about him I think, boy, that's not exactly what, you know, my pastor would say. That's not also exactly what my pastor would say. And I think the main difference is that Martin Luther King Jr. was trained at least partly in the social gospel movement. So the social gospel movement from 2 or 3 weeks ago is sort of like the social arm of the modernist movement. I could spend 3 classes on the social gospel. The long story short is when the modernist and the fundamentalist split in the early part of the 20th century, they want nothing to do with each other, and the fundamentalist movement becomes a private movement. It kind of forsakes, unlike previous times in American church history, it forsakes the public realm. I use this quote over and over. Dwight L. Moody would preach in Chicago, and he would say, "When I first used to preach in Chicago, I would carry a loaf of bread in one hand and my Bible in the other. But later, I only carried the Bible because if I fed someone, it was only for the day. But if I got them the Word of God, it was for all eternity." So the fundamentalist movement disavows public action. The modernist / liberal movement picks up social action. And so MLK is bred in kind of a cross-section of the social gospel movement along with black church movement, along with what we call just kind of straight up traditional American Protestantism. So you would hear it and you would say, right on, great, yeah, love it. And then every once in a while you'd say, huh, that's my pastor would not say that. They're great sermons, though. They are great sermons. The man didn't make a grocery list that didn't sound good. One more little plug. The last, if there is a recording that someone made of Martin Luther King's last address. I can't remember. It's in Memphis. I think it was the day before he was shot. And anyone who's interested in a great books education should read it, because it's just, he's like, he's so well trained in the classics. He knows the classics so well. He knows his Bible even better. So it's worth if you could just Google MLK's last speech or last address, it'll come up, and you'll value kind of the great books classical approach.
So part of the it seems to me that there are several large church, there's a contemporary church movement that's sort of along the lines of the social gospel that's sort of typified by, like, Mark Bell? What's his name? The guy who wrote
Mark
Velvet.
Driscoll and Rob Bell.
Rob Bell. That's who it is. Mark Bell's the power lifter. Rob Bell. So there's even someone like N.T. Wright, where there's a large focus on, we need to make this earth sort of the kingdom of heaven or something. Like, I disagree with him, but I don't want to sort of play down like what they're saying, but it seems like that's sort of what their message is largely. Is that totally irrelevant to how, I mean, that seems to be, is that just because what little remnants of Christianity are left, like, only connect with all the other parts of Christianity? And so it seems like a pretty big deal because I'm, like, part of whatever remnant of Christianity there is, and I see this happening, or is that totally irrelevant to the cultural milieu of America?
My sense is that what N.T. Wright and Rob Bell have in common, and they don't have much in common, because N.T. Wright is a profound and excellent scholar, and Rob Bell sells... So, man, Rob Bell does not... He's not a scholar. That's the kindest way I can say it. I think the thing that they have in common is an emphasis on the ethic of Christianity. And the ethic of Christianity precedes the doctrine of Christianity. And I know that N.T. Wright would say they are never divorced. And I think he does not say that they are divorced. But I think, whereas maybe a generation ago, the fight between the modernists and those critical of fundamentalists, they might have quibbled with their ethic, but more so I think they didn't like the fundamentalist beliefs. But now I think people who don't like Christians don't like Christians because of their ethic. They don't have as much a problem with their beliefs. You want to believe that Jesus raised from the dead? That's your own little thing. That's fine. But what you believe on such and such an issue, that is not acceptable to me. That's a change I think that's happened in the last 30 years. And I think both N.T. Wright and Rob Bell, and I like them in this way, both of them recognize that it's the ethical demands. Rob Bell. N.T. Wright emphasizes the ethical demands of Christianity and puts them at the fore. We are the people of God, act like it. You know, I don't know what Rob Bell's doing. No. I think you picked up on something that... There is that kind of like similarity between them, I think. No, N.T. Wright is N.T. Wright. He is doing... Yeah, he's very unique.
Yeah, one quick comment I was going to make on the whole thing of Christianity, modernism, having more plurality to that. Well, in the United States anyway, it seems to be that while demographics are changing, they seem to be changing in some areas and not others. And so... But the end result is we've got, so to speak, two Americas, one that's kind of somewhat rural and Christian, and then the other that's urbanized and is really has a lot of plurality and isn't friendly to modern Christianity.
Yeah, I think that's true. I think that it's obvious when you look at the blue and red map of the United States after elections that there are two very different kind of belief systems going on. I think, yeah, that is abundantly true. And it is interesting that the one belief system tends to congregate in cities and the other is spread out in rural areas. That's a whole senior thesis for somebody right there.
Definitely put my hours into Rob Bell and N.T. Wright, and I think they have... They're similarities, but they're radically different.
Mm.
Off of that, so demographic pluralism was kind of forced into America via the death of Christendom. So what you're saying, Christianity in some way died when it became irrelevant, and then rather than secularization happening because of, I guess it could be accounted for by talking about the human religious impulse, rather than secularization happening, you have pluralism happening?
I think there are two ways in which pluralism happened. One is just the United States has grown much, much more ethnically diverse in the 20th century, but even the last 50 years. And so with that ethnic diversity comes kind of a, not just ethnic pluralism, but sort of like pluralism of belief and practice. So I don't know that the death of Christianity, there's another sense, there's the second sense in which we talk about pluralism, which is we don't have a monoculture that has kind of one, that adheres to one set of values, but now we have many different cultures within the United States. So I think that maybe Christendom dying opened up the door for that, or that pluralism helped usher the end of Christendom. I think it's probably some of both. But I think people talk about pluralism in those two different ways, and it's oftentimes it gets kind of confusing for me. There's kind of pluralism of belief, and there's ethnic pluralism. It seems like ethnic pluralism tends to always bring in with it changes of beliefs or pluralism of beliefs also.
Because I guess, I mean, pluralism to a lot of people is this kind of dirty P word.
Mm-hmm.
For me, what it signifies is the humanization of what was really my neighbor the whole time, but now I recognize them as my neighbor.
Mm-hmm.
So when we come to America and we conquer Native Americans because they're different and you know our whole history, right? And we have black slaves and we're sending missionaries out to everybody else because they're languishing in their sin and we're the only ones who can help them. We have this really degrading view of people. And then it seems to me that after the death of cultural Christianity in America, the Hindu becomes my neighbor, the Muslim becomes my neighbor, the Buddhist becomes my neighbor, the pagan and the atheist and the philosophical theist become my neighbor, and they mow my lawn for me and watch my house when I'm gone or whatever. You know, these different situations where in these daily encounters where normally because of my inculcated Christianity and especially because of harsh words that are said from pulpits everywhere, I would be taught to demonize these people and think of them as these severely wicked human beings that are just sold to Satan and things like this. But then in my daily encounters, that's so different, right? They seem to actually share a lot of values that I have. And if they have a religious impulse, a lot of their religious impulse seems to come from the same place sometimes, and you begin to see commonalities. That's what I see that's good in pluralism. I think the only thing that could be seen as bad is if you start out saying we need to have a Christian culture. That's, do you see anything else that can be bad with pluralism other than just this idea we need to have a Christian culture? People need to be Christian here because that's the right way.
Right. I agree with you. I think it's kind of more in keeping with the gospel if we have a kind of pluralistic approach for the reasons that you just suggested. The only downside that I can think of is that it just makes, given our situation, it just makes arriving at decisions difficult. Doesn't make it impossible, but I think it just makes it more difficult, but not impossible. I think what frustrates me a little bit is that instead of a principled pluralism in which we could say, all right, listen, we have a pluralistic society now. Let's let Hindus come to the table. Let's let Christians come to the table. Let's let secularists come to the table. And let's each try to hash it out in some sort of public reasoned fashion. what we're going to do, what we're going to esteem as a country. I think that right now is it's not only prohibited, but I don't know that anyone would know how to do that. That just sounds so foreign to us right now. I don't think that it is foreign. I mean, I don't think that it's impossible. I think it's something that we should strive for. But right now, we are not prepared for that. We're just not prepared for that.
The reason being, right, because dominance is the easy way to make fast, quick decisions. So if you think on a small scale, you think in the marital household, that has the perspective that the male is the head over the household. He has the final word. I was just at a 3-day conference with fundamentalist Christians, and I was hanging out there. I was talking with women, and women were saying stuff like, "Women are stupid. They shouldn't be president. They shouldn't be in any state office." And I said, "Well, who told you that?" And they said, "You know, a man told me that." And we had a lot of discussions around biblical sexism, but I noticed very acutely that it's super easy to make decisions in the household if the final word is found in a man. Mm-hmm. And the consensus goes that direction because there's a trump card, right? And so similarly, like culturally, on a way bigger level, if there's this huge cultural Christian consensus that this is the way, man. Okay, we can come to the table, but we got the final trump card. Mm-hmm. If we're in a tough situation, that makes it a lot easier to have discussion. I think one of the reasons why divorce rates are up isn't necessarily because marriages are suckier, but because they've actually been sucky the whole time. And now women have a say to do mm-hmm. something about it. And I think, you know, our religious relations, our international relations, our social relations have really been sucky this whole time, but our Christianity has been like, you know, we're so awesome, we're calling the shots. Hmm. Does that make sense? I mean,
yeah. I think you're right. It seems like cultures inevitably swing back and forth between being a monoculture with a certain group that's on top, that's calling the shots, and it's more efficient to make decisions that way. But then it becomes, I mean, you can see it over and over in cultures. Then the situation becomes too oppressive, too binding, too narrow, and it swings the opposite direction towards something like pluralism. The pluralism then, because of whatever factors, because it's so messy, what have you, people get fed up with it, and the oppressed minority is no longer the oppressed minority, but my goodness, things are so cumbersome, difficult to manage. They swing back to kind of a monoculture. It happens over and over and over. Yeah. There are evils on both sides.
Yeah. How do you live there in that? Like, I think it's the right thing to do to have equality.
Mm-hmm.
Culturally, how do you live there in that place? I mean, it seems like people have to be really willing to dialogue. And in my experience with people, people just aren't really interested without playing power cards.
Yeah.
Because everybody wants to pull out their power cards. Nobody wants to dialogue around ideas and let the ideas hold their own weight. So I don't know. I see equality is the way to go, but I don't know. People are,
it's so true. It's so true. Whenever I start thinking about this, I just get so discouraged because I just think, man, give me one example from history, one example where people sat down. I mean, I'm not going to undermine my principal pluralism thesis, where people sat down and said, you know what, let's try to figure something out. Let's try to reach an agreement that works well for everybody. Maybe some of us will have to make some sacrifices. I'm going to be willing to make some sacrifices. Let's try to work it out. And I just see such seldom occasions of that happening. But man, I just think that why shouldn't Christians ought to lead the way? We could be the ones that say, you know what? Yeah, we're not going to fight for our rights as hard. We're going to advocate for your rights. Wouldn't that be a novel, great thing to happen? And I don't think that's beyond the realm of possibility. Any other thoughts or questions?
I'm kind of interested in that, your thesis that has the, like, the Great Awakening, the Second Great Awakening, that they've become less and less, like, focused on the content.
Yeah.
What, in American culture, what, do you think that there's something that has caused that? And anything that might change? Or I mean, what's left?
I think part of what prompted that during the Second Great Awakening was this sense that absent the church being in kind of like a privileged position in society, let's say like it was in Europe, then Christianity has still, to remain relevant, it has to appeal to more and more people. In that appeal, it might shave off, and it did shave off, kind of some of the harder teachings of Christianity. So I think it's not just that it became a less, that Christianity became less intelligent, it became less of an obstruction, I guess. It just became a little bit more rounded, a little bit easier to take, you know. Yeah, just a little bit easier to take. And so if Christianity doesn't see its primary goal as unifying culture or Christianizing culture or something like that, the more it can just kind of be itself, then I think that Christians are going to be less inclined, well, hopefully they'll be less inclined to shave off the harder teaching and just say, this is what Christianity it is. It's not my job to keep culture together. You know, this is between you and the scriptures, between you and God. That would be a great move forward, I think.
So if the broader culture decides to make us pay for abortions, and I feel like that's murder, so do you think that Christians should do as Christ told them in Rome, pay what is due to Caesar, and just take the attitude that this is just got his hand on the rulers of this age, and I just need to pay my taxes, and it's not my job to stop that.
Right.
Would you take that position? Or you might take the same issue, something like homosexual marriage. Some people may have a problem with that, but I may look, and I'm in a pluralistic society, and I think, I can't push my beliefs on the whole culture, so maybe I ought to just back off and say, yep, if they want to make that part of the laws, then maybe I shouldn't stand in the way. Is that an appropriate attitude to take in one or both of those?
I think there is absolutely a place where Christians draw the line against the governing authorities and say, we will not go there. The early Christians seemed to draw that line around against Caesar worship, and the Jews drew it against Caesar worship. We're not going to worship Caesar. There's one God. We're not going to worship this false God. But there are plenty of other vile practices that went on in the Roman Empire that Christians couldn't do anything about. Now, if my money was going, if I had to make a call about whether or not to not pay taxes because my tax money was going to support abortions, I might not pay taxes. That's a big one for me. But we're always having to figure out where we draw those lines. Is homosexual marriage where you draw one of those lines? It's not for me. But there are other places that I would say, like the abortion issue, I just cannot imagine giving tax money to like legitimize that and to make that happen. I can't imagine that. I think that's the kind of difficult that we're in. We're going to be in this constant renegotiating. What do we think is absolutely unacceptable? And it's going to have to just be this live issue. We can't just rubber stamp the decisions anymore.
I agree with your lines emotionally. That's where I would draw the lines. I'm not sure that I could make an argument for drawing a line here and not here. It would be, a lot of Christians would believe that it's not my job to be political and that's God's job, and it's my job to be holy in my own actions and and pay my taxes and that kind of thing. So, okay. I don't know what I'm asking, so, okay.
Okay. End of church history.